Hello and welcome to the front page from the Racing Post. I'm your host today, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr, and I'm thrilled to be joined in the studio by three of our very finest to discuss all the big stories coming out of a fascinating Derby weekend. To my immediate left, I have West Country correspondent James Stevens, writer, broadcaster, columnist, tipster Matty Pleo in the middle, and at the far end, deputy industry editor Peter Scargill, who was on the ground at Epsom on Saturday, chasing around after the phantoms of Animal Rising. And that's where we're going to start today, because they promised to do what neither the pandemic nor World War II could do and cancel the Derby. They swore that they would at least delay the race. And they said that their one red line was they would not go on the track during the race. Well, Animal Rising broke all of those promises because they failed to cancel the race, they failed to delay the race, and the one person who got on the track did so during the race. Peter, you were on the hunt on Saturday, as it were. What was the experience on the ground?
It was an interesting experience, shall we say. Obviously, there'd been all the build-up, all the sabre-rattling, all the threats, 1,000 people were going to come across the hill with their pink T-shirts on and delay the race. Obviously, we saw at Aintree, you know, people literally throwing themselves at the fence. Some people got onto the course and got onto the fences. So there was, you know, there was a precedent for what might happen. And there was, you know, the build-up to the race and, like you say, quite overt threats. I mean, you know, such overt threats, the Jockey Club were able to get their injunction because they were able to head to the High Court and say, look, guys, these people are saying they're going to do this. They've said it repeatedly. So, you know, it was not an insignificant day in that sense, but nobody turned up. Nobody turned up for various reasons, whether it was apathy, whether it's because of what the police did, whether it's because the Derby's not the Grand National. But in the end, it was a very disappointing day if you were an Animal Rising supporter.
We should say that the policing effort was clearly very successful because they arrested a number of activists in the hours preceding the race. And in addition to the one individual who did get on the track, I think there was a small number of other individuals who were prevented from doing so before they got on. But clearly, the thousands of protesters, or hundreds of protesters which were promised did not materialise. You know, first and foremost, a lot of credit has to go though to the Jockey Club and Surrey Police, because we spoke a lot about how difficult it is to defend Epsom with all that open ground, and they successfully managed it, I think far more successfully than anyone outside, and frankly a lot of people inside the Jockey Club expected.
Yeah, I mean, they were ready. If they underestimated potentially what Animal Rising might do at Aintree, and I think maybe we all did, because, you know, there was a bunch of people who turned up from nowhere who were saying things, and, you know, maybe we wrote them off as being extremists and crazy, which they sort of are, but, you know, in terms of preparation. This time round, you know, there was fencing everywhere. I have never seen so many fluorescent jackets as they were. I mean, everywhere, all the way down the straight on both sides. It didn't impact it if you were viewing. Albeit there wasn't that many people there, as it turned out, in terms of spectators. And they were ready, like they were pumped up, those security guards, and the people in charge, and the police, and the Jockey Club. It was like a big day for them, and, you know, sort of off the record, it was like, bring it on, lads. You know, if you think you can get through us like this, then fair play. But, you know, we've nailed you overnight. We've arrested key people. We've taken away your communications devices.
And maybe they weren't quite as sort of adept to this stuff as we thought they were. We'd sort of built them up in our minds into sort of the Bader Meinhof gang. In fact, they were probably more just a bunch of people who have never done anything like this before and don't really have a lot of experience causing civil disruption.
I mean, it comes across that way. They obviously have evolved, or not rebranded, probably a better way, out of Animal Rebellion, which is an offshoot of Extinction Rebellion. You'll remember all of the Occupy protests that were going on. I mean, the biggest fear sort of on Saturday was that Just Stop Oil might turn up. Because Just Stop Oil, who, you know, were at the Crucible and they stopped the England cricket team the other day and they've gone onto the courts at tennis. So they don't tell you what they're doing and they're very efficient in terms of getting on there. It seems that Animal Rising is seen a little bit as a joke in terms of disrupting based on what happened. In terms of the disruptors, the people who were out the front, perfectly lovely.
Yeah.
Perfectly lovely, friendly people dancing away, having a great time, odd views. But you know, they're not going to cause any trouble, really.
And Maddie, we saw afterwards, they did get one person on the track, and then following that incident, the Animal Rising's Twitter account put out a tweet in which they said, the Jockey Club has endangered the horses and the lives of those involved in the race by starting the race when a protest is on the track, even though in the background of their own video, there was a big screen that quite clearly showed the race had been off and running for several furlongs. I mean, in terms of sort of mendaciousness, that was extraordinary.
Yeah, and you mentioned at the top of the show about that sort of red line that they said they weren't going to cross, and they've just evidently crossed it and then thought that they'd got away with telling this lie, essentially. And I think ultimately, as Peter sort of said, it just totally takes an axe to their credibility or any credibility that they had. You know, we're hearing them come out now with much more extreme views, which I think naturally the public are going to find harder to relate to. And yeah, this was not a successful weekend if you were an Animal Rising follower or fan. I spoke to Ed Chamberlain, who was presenting for ITV across the Friday and the Saturday, and he sort of said he was very anxious, actually, and had security guards sort of protecting him, but also praised the Jockey Club and everyone involved for their collaboration and really coming together. And I think we saw that in how successfully, largely, this sort of operation was as a whole. I wonder, did you speak to any of the protesters? Do you sense that they're going to try this at any other events? I mean, we saw there was a climate-related incident at Ascot last year, wasn't there? Do you think we're going to...
Year before last, 21.
Yeah, we're going to get some more of this, do you think?
I don't. I mean, I spoke with the friendly protesters, the peaceful protesters, and, you know, they have... There's this sort of narrative that's developed that, you know, we're going to end thoroughbred racing and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, it's basically being used as a vessel to get to their main message, which is they want to sort out food production and what have you. And I think they probably saw racing as an easy target. It gets a lot of press coverage, television channels, and they probably thought, do you know what, we'll go into this, we'll disrupt it, we'll get a lot of coverage for it, and then we can get our main agenda on. And racing's basically not been the pushover that it thought it was going to be. The friendly protesters, they might protest other meetings. I suspect they won't be afforded the opportunities the Jockey Club gave them in terms of a friendly space that was, you know, sorted out over the donut summit in London last month. But it's, I don't know, getting into Royal Ascot, I mean, that was Extinction Rebellion under the guys, they were catering staff,
yeah,
weren't they?
Yeah.
So they'll be wise to that. Getting into Ascot's more tricky.
A lot more security.
It's a lot more security. Well, you know, you've got the Royals, and then, you know, talk about Goodwood. But I mean, is anyone really going down to Goodwood protest? I mean, the Grand National was their moment, and they sort of took it, and they've almost overplayed their hand to some extent.
Yeah.
But they're just, I don't know. I mean, they've got, you know, Ben Newman, the guy that got on the course. He's in court today. They might get some coverage out of that, but I suspect they'll go off and they'll keep
just
pouring
finally,
milk on the floor and stuff
on
like
this,
that.
On their getting coverage, you know, because this is an important point, because this is sort of the most high profile sort of challenge to racing that's taking place in the sort of public sphere, you know, in a long time basically. But their sort of worldview, you talked about food production, but it's not really just food production. It's any involvement between animals and humans. So
domestic pets
mm-hmm. Exactly, they do not believe people should have cats and dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's not just sort of saying we don't think there should be dairy farming or we don't think there should be animal sports. They don't think there should be any relationship between humans and animals, which is, you know, it's an extraordinarily extreme view, and they sort of get compared with Just Stop Oil, you know. But Just Stop Oil's views in many respects are actually far more mainstream, more mainstream in terms of, you know, sort of suggesting there's a climate catastrophe that needs to be tackled than Animal Rising's. So, you know, their views being given a platform, I think, has actually been to their detriment, because people have sort of looked at this initially, thought, oh, they're taking an issue with horse racing, but in fact, they've now realised it's a far, far more extreme sort of worldview than that.
Yeah, I think one of the other sort of key elements to what happened on the weekend is that in the build-up to the derby, we saw a lot of coverage about what they were going to do, what they were going to do, and how much of a big threat they were going to be to disrupting the race. And the fact they didn't do it, I think, will probably make those sort of news editors, those big TV companies, just think twice and just be a little bit more cautious about how much sort of coverage to give them. And I think from a public perspective, which in theory is who they're trying to convince and who they're trying to send their message to, it looked reckless, it looked dangerous, and I think if that is their approach to trying to convince people to that way of thinking, I'm not sure it's going to work.
Just one final thing. I think this is kind of almost informative for racing, because they might not no longer be the sort of creditable opposition Animal Rising, but we've sort of had a trial run of how best racing can defend itself, both in person when it comes to policing. I mean, Aintree are surely going to learn lessons from Epsom, and also, you know, fans of racing and racing in the media and stand up to racing, how we defend our sport that way. So in a way, we can play down Animal Rising and say they might not be all that potent and powerful a force, but you know, we still need to take seriously anyone who is coming out and opposing racing, and it could almost be helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's given racing an opportunity to think about how it presents itself publicly. It's a very good point. Before we move on to our second story, a very quick commercial notice, because we are running a fantastic competition for you to win a trip to the Breeders' Cup at stunning Santa Anita. All you have to do is place a bet on our app. Watch this video to find out more. Welcome back. On to our second story, and we're sticking with Epsom, and we're going to talk about what we're dubbing the debacle on the Downs. In the Dash, where four of the 20 runners were released from the stalls fractionally after the rest, it's the world's fastest race, and yet the stewards took no action at all. James, what do we think about this? You know, on the surface, it looks absolutely ridiculous that they claim that there was no impact at all, because you only have to look at where the affected horses finished and their starting prices to sort of ascertain that clearly they all dramatically underperformed.
Yeah, I think just to sort of go back to what happened, for those that might not have seen, I mean, it's said to be the fastest race in the world, as you say, but it's very difficult to do when the stalls aren't open. Mm. So we saw that the four of the five widest stalls, slow motion shots will indicate that those stalls did not open simultaneously with the other stalls, which of course opens up a huge question mark as to what should have happened with the race. Now, there are a number of options. The race could have been voided, which means essentially just agreed that it was not fair. And under some BHA regulations, if there is an impact from the stalls or there's a failure from the stalls, that will take place. But in this situation, the BHA came out and said that they did not feel that the runners were materially impacted, is what they said on the stewards' report, compared to the rest of the field. So that the slow motion shots prove that, well, the stalls did open, it was only a fraction, and it didn't really affect them, which is quite an interesting point of view.
Sort of stewarding philosophy that basically, unless the margin of victory or defeat was so small that you think it could have been overcome, then there's no impact. But which is absolutely ridiculous, because if someone has a run stopped, then the impact is going to be more than a nose, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, there were different things that could have happened. They could have said those horses were non-runners, and we've had David Evans speak in the newspaper today, who trained Lee Hoove, called the race a farce, said that his cost should be reimbursed because he didn't get a run for his money, which is fair. I mean, my perspective is that if the stalls don't open on time, it's sort of black and white. They either do or they don't. And how much you can decide, okay, well, that didn't have an impact, but that did. I think that's a little bit dangerous of a sort of place to be looking at from a sport. I think, in my own honest opinion, I just look at it and go, well, if they opened on time, they didn't. If they did, they did. And I mean, the other interesting element to all of this is that the World Pool, it was one of the biggest days for Whirlpools. You've got countries that are betting on British racing that otherwise wouldn't be looking at it. So there's those sort of implications as well. I mean, yeah, look, the horses were sent off, including the 6-1 favourite, Live in the Moment. They finished 14th, 15th, 17th and 20th. You cannot say that they didn't perform to strength, because they clearly didn't. I mean, one of them, on the basis of sort of expectations, would have run in the top 10 at the very least. So, yeah, an interesting situation. And the final point I'll make is from the Horse Race Bettors Forum, who are essentially a voice of the punter. They felt the race should have been null and void and stakes refunded. So it has implications on punters too.
What do we think, Maddie? I kind of feel void would have been a little bit extreme, but surely these have to be non-runners. They've not got a fair run.
Yeah, I'd probably be inclined to agree with that. For me, the thing I had an issue with is just the wording of the stewards' report. They said that they tested the stalls as per their procedure beforehand and everything was smooth, but that several horses anticipated the start, broke open the gates shortly before the start was affected. Well, how can you then go on to say, on balance, none of those runners' chances were materially impacted? Well, you're saying horses have physically forced the gates open. So the fact that that is okay in this instance, do we need to then go back and look at how the stalls are actually working on a day-to-day basis then? If it's, you know, absolutely fine for horses to break their way through, causing, you know, a result like this, what does that mean in every other case? So I thought the wording of the stewards' report was contradictory, insufficient, pretty poor. And regards to voiding the race or not, I can understand why they didn't take the decision to void the whole race. But for me, in this scenario, you want, where there's confusion and conjuncture, you want clarity and you want confidence and you want lots of... you know, you want to be able to understand how the decisions were reached. And in this case, I really don't think that's what's happened.
Yeah, Pete, where we wanted clarity, it feels a bit more like we got complacency.
Yeah, and I don't know, there's many factors. I mean, if I was Animal Rising, I'd have said that we affected the start of this race and we caused the carnage, because that got more attention than what they did. It would have been a PR win for them.
Dash in the Derby confused.
Yeah, absolutely. We were there. We told the horse to accelerate out the gate beforehand. I mean, looking at the rules, they were saying that they could void the race if it was a third of the field affected by the stalls. And it was this materially affected line. I don't know whether, because it was a quarter, it was deemed, you know, it was below the threshold. Therefore, that was fine. And there's also this Whirlpool element. You know, there are issues in terms of different rules in different countries. And
this would never happen in Hong Kong, though, would it?
In terms of the stalls would fail, or in terms of the farce afterwards?
I mean, there's both. Probably,
there's been issues with the stalls and the Whirlpool before. I think of Royal Ascot, back at Sylvester the Sousa horse, which Godolphin horse name I can't remember, and Harry Angel slightly before the Whirlpool start. So, I mean, there have been issues with the stalls and the problems it's caused. So is this an incident where they've gone, well, we can kind of get through it without voiding it, it keeps the Whirlpool going? I don't know whether it's that extreme, but there are many elements involved in this, aren't
ultimately,
there?
The losers are the connections and anyone who bet on those four horses, because you can be absolutely certain that what happened meant you had no chance whatsoever. Basically,
well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you need good track position in that race because it's hard to make up ground. Albeit you obviously see some flying late. These horses were fancied, and it just your run was gone.
Yeah,
and look, we all of us involved in races go to races with expectation, and sometimes it doesn't work out. But you don't kind of expect it to work out because of the stalls. I don't know, if I was the jockey club, perhaps I'd be inclined to give these guys a call up and say, look, I'm sorry it didn't work out for you, perhaps we can make some kind of amends, a gesture, perhaps.
Yeah. They need to do that for all the thousands of punters though as well, which
I hadn't considered that. Yes. That's why I'm not in charge of racing. Too micro.
Give it time. We're going to move on to the third story, because another of the many, many fascinating angles coming out of Epsom Maddie was Frankie Dettori, who is riding out of his skin this season. The punters love him. He's loving life. And he had an Oaks Day double, which was included the Oaks itself and Tall Sister. Everyone's asking now, almost predictably, is he actually going to retire? Is he going to walk away from this when he's at the top of his game?
Yeah, this is something that our colleague Lewis Porteous wrote about recently as well, that he sort of wouldn't blame him for taking a U-turn on that. And the more I think about it, the more I'm thinking the same. And it's a fascinating story, this, because, of course, we have the subtext of last year and the John Gosden sabbatical that was. So Frankie Dettori, perhaps, you know, forced by that, you know, maybe thought, OK, perhaps my time has come and this is the time to wind it down. He's very much a confidence rider. And you saw that with the ride to give Emily Upjohn and Soul Sister, you know, from the back of the field. Yes, he had plenty of horse under him, but wasn't afraid to go the wider route and just delivered them beautifully, and also Prosperous Voyage and several others that we've seen this season, you know, Little Big Bear, etc., for Aidan O'Brien at Haydock. Went to Santa Anita, was riding out a lot. He said sort of 9 rides a day. So that would have helped him reach full fitness. It would have helped his confidence. You know, it's a nice climate. He clearly gets along very well with how things run over there. And since he's come back, he's just been in electric form. He's not riding very often. He's picking and choosing his big days, as he always has done, but perhaps to an even more severe degree. And his relationship with John Gosden seems pretty solid. So he said on Look on Sunday yesterday that he still plans to retire on October 21st and that 4 months is a long time in racing. So do you take that as 4 months is plenty of time for me to lose this illustrious streak, or 4 months is plenty of time for me to change my mind and see what develops? So now I guess the questions are, what is it going to take for him to stay? Is he going to want a champion two-year-old that he can take into his three-year-old season? Is he going to want a Derby contender? Is he going to want one of the star older horses to stay in training next year? And is there any way that he could change his mind? He has done before, and we've seen similar jockeys, Jamie Spencer, etc., retire, Hayley Turner come back. And I think there's an argument to be said that we're witnessing peak Dettori at the moment. He's using all his experience, all that confidence to deliver on track. Fans are loving it. He's loving it.
He is 52. Is it not the argument that, you know, he's decided he's going to go out, he's riding out of his skin, what better time to hang up your boots? Because the flip side is, if you don't retire when you're at your best, you're going to retire when you're not at your best, which is sort of a sad denouement to an otherwise unbelievable career. So there's a danger in hanging around, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, if I was Frankie personally, I think I would stick to the plan. Because also it's slightly embarrassing having to make that U-turn, even if you are as popular as Frankie is.
There's a lot of retirement events. There's a big retirement dinner on Champions Day and stuff. So it'd be slightly embarrassing going to everyone like, actually.
Same time again next year.
He's image conscious as well, Frankie, isn't he? Let's be frank. He's a guy that wants to be seen doing his flying dismounts, whatever he might say it does to his ankles. He wants to be loved. He wants to be seen kissing the turf at Epsom and everyone. You know, when he went through that period after he lost the Godolphin job and he came back and he was in the doldrums, I mean, that wasn't what he wanted to do. And perhaps that's impacted him as well, because then he found Al Shikab and he found Golden Horn and this relationship with Gosden, and he's kicked on. I mean, because you either retire or you get retired, don't you?
Yeah.
So if he can go out and he's riding everywhere and everyone goes, oh, Frankie, please stay.
Then he goes,
oh, guys, I can't. I've said I'm going to retire. And then he can go off and he can go and do a media career and I don't know, whatever the thing you do. And everyone says, oh, Frankie, you should still be riding. Oh, guys, I had to retire, guys. I said it was.
It's a great way to go out.
Do you know what I mean?
Great way to go out when everyone is clamouring for you to stay.
Yeah, rather than, oh, hang on, I haven't really got a horse for the Kentucky Derby, or I'm going to ride a 66-1 shot in the Derby. Oh, God, I really wish I'd retired last year. I suspect how it looks is probably is driving it as much as what's going on.
I think you made a very good point, Maddie, that the one thing that would genuinely cause him to really struggle with that is if he got an amazing horse, sort of another Enable or something. If someone, a horse came along that was going to take him to that sort of level, it would be hard for him to walk away, because he'd be walking away from that story with that horse.
I think it, yeah, and as Pete said, it's public facing, and this is about his legacy, etc. And Enable was unique because it wasn't necessarily her ability, as fantastic as she was, it was her relationship with the public, and he was had a very unique connection with her compared to other great horses that he's ridden. So for a horse to forge that sort of relationship with him and the public, I think is going to be a big ask, but who's to say it can't happen, because he is scooping everything before him at the moment anyway.
It's amazing. Just before we go on to our final story today, a quick advert for Racing Post Members Club Ultimate, which is our top tier subscription service, gets you access to all the fantastic journalism from the Racing Post top journalists, and access to lots of tools, replays, etc. on the Racing Post website as well. Watch the video, please. Welcome back, and for our final story, we are doing the reverse of From the Sublime to the Ridiculous, and having begun with Animal Rising, we are going to finish with the master himself, Aidan O'Brien, who masterminded what has been described as one of the training performances of the century, bringing back Auguste Rodin from a 22-length stuffing in the 2000 Guineas to a brilliant Derby win on Saturday. James, where do we rank this one in the stratosphere of O'Brien's remarkable achievements?
Well, for me, I would say it's the best one I can remember. I think that he talks a lot about how things went wrong at Newmarket, and just the getting there was a problem because of the sort of security needed because of the coronation. But the horse was just a completely different horse to what we saw at Epsom. And I think the transition within pretty much a month, it's just extraordinary. To do that is very special, and credit to all of his team. I mean, I have done some digging about how good the performance was compared to the others, and he improved his Racing Post rating £68. But being Aidan O'Brien, he's actually done that better than that twice before. So Power in 2012 was 17th in the 2000 Guineas, won the Irish 2000 Guineas and was £82 better.
Wow.
And Roderick O'Connor the year before was £72 better. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised for Aidan O'Brien. Extraordinary trainer, and yeah, the Derby winner looks very good. I mean, I've got the chance to say, would I back him in the Arc? No, because I think we saw the winner at Epsom in Emily Upjohn, who was seriously impressive. Acceleration she showed. So yeah, great racing on the whole, but my, never discount Aidan O'Brien.
It is amazing, because in the run-up to the race, I think everyone was sort of saying, you know, how is Auguste Rodin favourite? He ran like a block of wood at Newmarket. Aidan O'Brien, of course, was telling everyone who would listen, this horse is something incredibly special. But how many people actually believed that, Maddie? I mean, enough for him to remain prominent in the market, clearly, but publicly, there's a lot of skepticism.
Yeah, and I'll volunteer myself. I was one of those of thinking this is a huge task. But Aidan O'Brien, all the way through, that's been the theme of the build-up to this year's Derby, if it wasn't Animal Rising, was that he had so much confidence behind Auguste Rodin, and he could pinpoint where things went wrong. You know, it wasn't an inexplicable, dismal effort in the Guineas. They, as James pointed out, they had the travel, they had the impeding of him a little big bear in the race, but still he had to answer several questions here. You know, a son of Deep Impact, he is totally unique. That's why I had Saxon Warrior in this race, and he of course didn't really get the trip, but he took the 4 furlongs in his stride and looks a real powerhouse. For me, one of the best things about this performance I thought was I thought he was given a brilliant ride by Ryan Moore. When King of Steel got out, Kevin Stott was very adamant that, you know, he was going straight away, whereas Ryan Moore, you sense he was just holding on a little bit more and timing his run to perfection. And that's nothing against Kevin Stott, because I don't think, you know, he could have won the race anyway. But also how well balanced this horse was in the final stages. You know, at Epsom, we saw it with Soul Sister in the Oaks. She leant into the camber and ended up more or less along the rail, and we often see horses wandering around a little bit because it is a challenging terrain, straight as you could like. He's very athletic, he's a beautiful mover, and I'm really excited to see what he can do next.
And a word for King of Steel as well, Pete, because Roger Varian, you know, probably deserves a similar sort of level of credit to Aidan O'Brien, because in the lead up to the race, he sort of said, I think King of Steel is actually going to massively outrun his odds, and sure enough, he ran an absolute storming race. Kevin Stott gave him a great ride, even though he was quite critical of himself afterwards. That's a serious performance right there.
Yes, it's a sort of eye-rolling sometimes, isn't it, when people train outsiders for big races, perhaps for prominent owners who you think maybe are exerting some pressure on them to only go, yeah, okay, fine, you say it's going to run well.
Cynic, Pete.
he is a gargantuan, he's a big, huge, impressive horse, and the way he went around Epsom was very impressive with that regards. The horse obviously had been due to run at the Dante, had to go all the way up to York, got upset in the stalls, so had to overcome that. Now, fair play to him, he delivered it really well, just got beaten by a better horse. Mm. Better horse who I suspect relished the ground at Epsom as opposed to Newmarket. I know he'd won on heavy ground at Doncaster, but that handicappers certainly weren't convinced by that run at Doncaster, so the ground probably helps. And I just thought it was interesting, when Aidan O'Brien was interviewed after the race, they were talking about future plans, and he talked about sort of being free from the shackles of the Triple Crown, because he got beat in the Guineas.
Yeah, of course.
And now they could go to, well, they didn't have to go to the Ledger. Actually, that was quite an interesting way of viewing it. This thing that we still hold, some of us, the idea of maybe there'll be another Triple Crown winner, wasn't it unfortunate that Camelot didn't do it? But actually, sometimes the trainers actually don't want to do it at all. And well, they'd rather go for different races.
I think they recognise, though, I mean, if you
it's not commercial, is it?
If you take August Rodin, you know, they recognise that clearly a mile was too short, and that a mile six in the Ledger would be testing. But that's the beauty of the Triple Crown. It's a shame, actually, that more trainers aren't sort of inclined to go, and owners aren't inclined to go down that route, because, you know, ultimately, if they come up short, that's disappointing. But it's only by undergoing these sort of tests that push the limits of these animals' natural ability that you are going to uncover the true greats. And, you know, sadly, we're not going to see a Triple Crown winner this year, but I love the fact that they actually care about that.
So if I'm a cynic, you're a romantic, are you?
This is it. This is it. Just before we wrap up our Epsom discussions, Maddie, any other sort of equine takeouts from it? We've mentioned Soul Sister, we've mentioned Emily Upjohn. They were obviously a couple of other key stars.
Yeah, a couple of points. Just sticking with the Derby for now, from a form perspective, I think it was a little bit of a sort of temper enthusiasm because a couple of the key players didn't really perform. Arrest blatantly didn't handle the ground or the track. Passenger faded really dimly. There were some others in there who just didn't really seem to take to it. The Foxes ran very well, probably once 10 furlongs again. But I would have, and you had the two break clear, so that sort of makes you think, how well did the rest deal with the challenge? Elsewhere, I wrote a piece in today's paper. I was quite interested by what John Gosden had to say on Benoit de La Sayette after he won the race named after Lester Piggott. Sort of said he gave him Torito a Lester Piggott-esque ride, and I was sort of delving into whether or not Benoit could be the new Frankie Dettori. He's clearly going to be part of the future at Clare Haven, so it remains to be seen how he's going to step up. No claim now, of course, which is a big talking point, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see him in the winner's enclosure at Royal Ascot.
Great, Maddie. And just before we wrap up everything, guys, we've got a little bit of breaking news, actually, because we are going to be publishing on Racing Post later this morning, as I speak, as we film, but earlier today, as we release this, that Oliver Sherwood is bringing his decorated training career to a close. James, just a word on Oliver's achievements.
Yeah, an incredible trainer who's sort of been one of those trainers that's been around through all the changes around jump racing. It's a game that that period of time that he's the game is completely transformed, and he's always operated at a very high level. I mean, from a personal perspective, I absolutely loved Many Clouds. Mm, I thought just that's bringing him to win what was a Hennessy then, I think. Possibly was Ladbrokes Trophy, I don't know, but it is the Hennessy.
Yeah.
And then win a Grand National of a big, big weight. It was an incredible.
And then that devastating day at Cheltenham with Thistle Track.
Yeah.
An unbelievable performance with such a heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was. And I think that he, for many people, is remembered for that sort of, that kind of very easy to understand story, isn't it? Just sort of the great high and then a really crippling low, and his emotion and his honesty of dealing with something like that is something that I think a lot of people remember, especially sort of my age, who were sort of, that was sort of the time they really got into betting and watching racing, and seeing that sort of emotional connection was quite special. A great trainer, he's always been a pleasure to deal with, and yeah, I mean, best of luck to him in his new venture.
Yeah, absolutely. Very best of luck to Oliver. So it remains for me to decide what's going to go on the front page. Let me think. It's been Derby week. We're probably going to do the Derby winner. I would say that is the natural Racing Post front page. And so that brings us to a close this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you very much to my panellists in the studio. And we hope to see you again next week. Before we go, though, we've got an advert for the Racing Post app, which you can use to get your fill of racing news, views, cards, and all the rest in the meantime. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next week.